Hello, once again, welcome to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Greyhawk.
And I'm your co-host, Jackson Eflin.
Thank you for joining us for episode 7 of our Disney bracket. This week we have Sleeping Beauty versus The Fox and the Hound. This is another one of those weird mashups.
There's really not a lot in common. Usually I can find something, but people living in the woods have problems with people living not in the woods.
There's also the drastic change in tone and style between these two films.
Mm-hmm. One is a very stylized fairy tale film. The other is a significantly less stylized woodsy parable.
And they're almost exactly 20 years apart. Sleeping Beauty is 1959 release, whereas Fox and the Hound is 1981.
Fox and the Hound does not feel like an 80s movie. It feels way older.
To be fair, I don't think the 80s quite started in 81.
That's true. It feels like it belongs in the same general time period of the 60s. Then
all of the other weird stuff, like Robin Hood and Sword in the Stone.
Yeah.
Fox and the Hound does fall into that sort of time bracket post-Jungle Book, where it's kind of considered the Disney Dark Ages. Mm. After Walt had died, Disney didn't quite find their footing again until 89 with The Little Mermaid. So there is a huge swath of more experimental stuff. Not all of it works.
Yeah. We should get into summaries before we talk about the movies.
That's very true. So, Sleeping Beauty. King Stefan and Queen Leah celebrate the birth of their daughter, Princess Aurora. Among the invited guests are King Hubert and his son, Prince Philip, who is betrothed to Aurora to unite the two kingdoms. Additionally, the fairies Flora, Fauna, and Merryweather are invited and bestow blessings to the child. But before Merryweather is able to offer her gift, the gathering is interrupted by Maleficent, who questions why she was not invited. Offended at their lack of hospitality, Maleficent curses Aurora with death by spindle prick on her 16th birthday. Merryweather, while not powerful enough to remove the curse, softens the death to eternal slumber, which she can be woken from by true love's kiss. To further protect Aurora, the fairies take the child with them and hide in the forest until her 16th birthday. There she grows up as Briar Rose, using her gifts of beauty and song to make friends with the woodland creatures. On her 16th birthday, Briar Rose is sent out by her guardians to fetch berries as a cover for a surprise party. While in the forest, she meets Prince Philip, and they fall for each other after a duet together. Back at the cottage, the fairies have broken their vow against magic to prepare Aurora's gifts, which catches the attention of Maleficent's familiar. After Briar Rose returns, the fairies reveal her royal heritage and tell her she can't marry the man in the woods, and take her to the castle. Aurora is heartbroken, and the fairies give her space, allowing Maleficent to enchant her and prick her finger, fulfilling the curse. She then captures Philip and imprisons him in her dungeon. The fairies help Philip escape, give him a sword and shield to defeat Maleficent and break Aurora's curse. He does, and he and Aurora marry. The end.
Also, death by spindleprick, TM'd band name. Meanwhile, in The Fox and the Hound, a hunter kills a fox. An owl, Big Mama, leads her orphan kit, Todd, to the home of lovely old Widow Tweed. Todd makes friends with a neighbor's new puppy, Copper. When Copper goes on his first hunting trip with his master, Amos, and older mentor, Chief, Big Mama tells Todd that Copper will come back a hunter, not a friend. Todd refuses to believe her. Todd's attempts to reconnect lead to Amos and his dogs hunting Todd into the woods. Copper lets Todd go just this once, but as he makes his escape, Chief chases him and gets hit by a train. Copper vows revenge. For his safety, Widow Tweed releases Todd into the woods, where he fails to make friends and influence people. Big Mama sets him up with Vixie, a lady fox who could do so much better. Amos and Copper track Todd down and try to kill him, but a bear interrupts. Todd saves Copper from the bear, nearly dying in the process. When Amos turns his gun on Todd, Copper interposes himself, and they all drop it and go home. Todd and Vixie watch Copper from afar, everyone cry. Oh, also, there's two birds trying to catch a worm who turns into a butterfly.
I mean, I left out some stuff in my synopsis, yeah. Too.
I think the problem that both these movies have is padding.
Yes. Both films have a lot of stuff going on that is not necessarily moving the plot forward. Although, I do think Sleeping Beauty has less of a problem with that than Fox and the Hound does.
Yeah. There's nothing in Sleeping Beauty that I don't care about. It's all either moving the plot along or it's a fun scene.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably the least necessary part is when King Stefan and King Hubert are talking about their plans for after Aurora comes back and where they're going to live, and it leads to a sort of drunken sword fight, and King Hubert grabs a fish instead of a blade, and King Stefan defends himself with a plate. Nothing in that scene advances the plot that much, but it's still a fun scene.
Whereas Fox of the Hound has a lot of sort of scenes like that. They have some musical montages, especially during the winter season during the film, where all of that is pretty much just a musical montage to move time forward.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm noticing more and more that Disney has a lot of those things happening to pretty music, and I'm usually fine with it. But we've gotten to the point now where I've seen them use those things happening to music to advance the plot, and so seeing this movie not doing that makes it feel less worth it.
Well, let's go ahead and start our deep dive on Sleeping Beauty.
A place we really disagreed was the aesthetic. I loved the aesthetic of this movie.
I did not. So, the aesthetic of this film is this really weird combination of 60s architectural and fashion design, almost art deco, combined with illuminated manuscript and, like, medieval tapestries. It's a very odd combination of things, and I don't think it works.
There aren't a lot of movies that use moving illuminated manuscripts for a reason. They're kind of a hard art design to work with. You got a few things like Secret of the Kells that do it, and it kind of works. I think the reason it works here is because they kind of dive into it. Everything feels like pieces of a stage that you're moving around that are more meant to be the idea of a tree than an actual tree. Like those weird 8-story tall giraffe trees that just go straight up and have like one block of Dr. Seuss leaves and that's it.
They show those off like 2 or 3 times in the movie, and I question why they were so proud of that.
Whereas I'm like, no, I feel this. It's a weird Enchanted Forest vibe.
I will readily admit that the criticism on the aesthetics of this film from me is very subjective. I don't think the animation or the art are bad necessarily. I want to leave an addendum with that, though. Every scene within the castle or the palace or what have you, there are way too many colors. It looks like you kind of just dumped a paint palette on the animation cells. I think if they would have narrowed their palette a little bit more, like they do in the woods or Maleficent's castle, I would have much less of a problem with things. But it looks super gaudy and ugly with the array of colors that they chose.
Whereas the colors don't bother me, if only because all the colors have about the same saturation. Because I can see they're going for a very consistent something, I can appreciate that.
And while this is definitely a pedantic criticism...
Oh, I'm so excited about this.
None of the heraldry in the film follows medieval rules of tincture, and it bothers the crap out of me.
So, for people in the audience, how does that work?
Basically, you have to understand that in the rules of tincture, there are about 6-ish colors. There's a few that get tacked on, but in general, there is ore and argent, which are white and yellow, effectively.
And that stands for gold and silver.
Yes. And those are the metals. And then you have, rather than use the obscure terms, I'm just going to go black, red, green, blue. Occasionally purple.
And then some, like, obscure things will have, like, a teal or a rust or whatever, but it's mostly those.
Yeah. And the basic rules of tincture say that you can't put one item of the heraldry on top of another from the same category. So you can't put a metal next to a metal, and you can't put a color next to a color. You can see this a lot in coat of arms for the British royal family, colors for national flags, things like that. They follow a lot of the same rules because it makes bold patterns that are easily recognizable from a distance that also look good.
How do you know about this?
Because I'm a huge nerd and also do D&D world building stuff.
I'm glad you mentioned D&D completely out of the blue and without me prompting you, because a part of the reason I think this movie is kind of fun is it feels a bit like a D&D campaign. You mentioned how Maleficent has a familiar because she's very obviously some sort of spellcasting class with presumably an occult pact. The fairies are all giving buffs to the paladin prince, and then there's Form of Dragon 2 being used right here. I know it's not necessarily always a good reason to like things. Many not good things based on D&D, from most D&D movies to mazes and monsters, but the more pulpy style of fantasy on display here as opposed to the more fairy tale-esque fantasy on display in, say, Cinderella or Snow White kind of works for me.
Although, if we're bringing in D&D, I'm going to be pedantic again and black dragons don't breathe fire.
Okay, no. That's true. However, Infernal Pact is kind of a warlock thing, and most warlocks don't get familiars, so clearly this is homebrew.
I mean, you're also assuming 5th edition.
This is getting perhaps too off topic. So let's reel things back to Prince Philip, because he's...
But I haven't talked enough about how all of the backgrounds feel like set constructions as opposed to actual backgrounds.
I love that they all feel like set constructions, not actual backgrounds.
Okay, now we can talk about Prince Philip.
Okay. Prince Philip and Aurora both have more personality compared to, say, Snow White. Briar Rose has more humor and cunning.
I do think here we're starting to see a little bit of the more Renaissance sensibilities peeking out from Disney. Aurora gets a nose. And yes, I will continue to mention that because it is always worth note. There's a lot more personality in the protagonists here than we have seen chronologically from Disney.
I mean, there could be more. These characters aren't necessarily like deep meditation of the human soul, but I'm not bored when the princesses are on screen.
Also, at least the prince here gets a name.
Yeah, he also has the best line in the movie where his dad is like,
"You're a prince, and you're going to marry a princess."
"Now, father, you're living in the past. This is the 14th century.
There are some weird anachronisms because
there
of that line.
Are there raccoons in this movie, though?
There aren't, thankfully. Raccoons were introduced into Germany during the middle of the 20th century. So anytime you see raccoons in Disney movies, it is an anachronism. The one downside, though, between Aurora and Prince Philip, you still have the whole love at first sight thing. They are head over heels for each other when they first meet as adults after a single duet. And while we were watching, we definitely both thought of, you can't marry someone you just met from Frozen. So...
And with teenagers, I don't mind love at first sight. I mind we're getting married because of love at first sight, but I don't mind love at first sight as a thing. And I think that's something that could have so easily dodged by not being like, we're definitely getting married now as a thing.
Yeah. So why don't we go ahead and jump into the fairies now?
There's a reading that they are the main characters. They kind of do the most things, are the most proactive, and have the most change and growth of anybody.
I definitely agree with that. I honestly think thinking of them as the protagonists probably is better for the film.
The way that the fairies have only a minimal sense of human morality is really fun.
Yeah, everyone will be sad if they know that the curse befell Aurora. We'll just put them all to sleep until she wakes up. You then later realize, up until they figure out what's going on with Prince Philip, they had no clue how they were going to wake up Aurora.
Nope. Or how Flora's first plan is, oh, we'll turn Aurora into a flower. Flowers can't prick their fingers. They don't have fingers. Without thinking that maybe Aurora might want some say in being a flower. Or without thinking that maybe flowers are very delicate things that could die in other ways.
They also kind of just decide to take Aurora. It's like, oh, we'll talk to the king and make him see reason.
Which is definitely in line with a lot of older myths and legends about fairies as these very blue and orange morality creatures. And I think it works. We're also not talking about the best fairy in this movie, Maleficent.
There's a reason that Maleficent is one of the best Disney villains of all time.
There's a reason that I have the Mistress of All Evil nail polish. And she's not even necessarily a particularly competent villain. She has her minions going around looking for Aurora without realizing that they're looking for a baby because they don't realize that humans grow up. While it makes her feel kind of incompetent, it's also great watching her go,
"Oh, they're hopeless. A disgrace to the forces of evil."
I saw that much more as I am surrounded by idiots.
It's true. As someone who has a fondness for villains, I feel bad for her and want her to be happy. There's a bit where Fauna is saying that Maleficent knows nothing of kindness or love, and we see that throughout the film, that she's sort of only happy when she's making other people miserable, and she seems really bored and sad when she's not.
There's also the fact that she just has a lot of screen presence. Whenever Maleficent is on screen, it's all about her. The scenes in her castle are some of the best in the film.
Those purple and greens.
The purple and greens, the texture on the weathered stone.
Even her raven is threatening. Her raven is more threatening than some actual Disney villains.
Yeah, Maleficent is probably one of the best parts of this film.
Yeah.
A couple other small notes. This film does pass the Bechdel test because of the three fairies and their bickering. However, Queen Leia gets shafted. She gets maybe one or two lines in the film when Maleficent first shows up, but even at the end, she doesn't get to, "Oh, I'm so happy to see my daughter." She just gets a hug, and that's it. That's kind of crappy. The fight choreography for the dragon fight is awful.
And to be fair, we're coming off of Mulan, which has some really great animated fight choreography, but...
I mean, even Beauty and the Beast has some really great fight scenes. Here, it's just really boring and not that interesting. I would have loved some sort of Errol Flynn swashbuckling stuff going on with Prince Philip and Maleficent minions down, like, a staircase or something. Other points, the Foley in this film is noticeably subpar. The music is fine, but the sound effects and whatnot, I don't know what it is. It just, they seemed off. Also, the mind control scene right before Aurora is cursed, with Maleficent kind of dragging her up that staircase and whatnot. It's a neat scene. I think it goes on a little too long.
I'll agree with you, but that scene is a good lead-in for one of the strongest things about this movie, I think. Maleficent sort of points and beckons, and Aurora wanders towards her. And you can tell that Aurora's been hypnotized because her expression is just this dead blank stare. That works because they really have good expressions from the characters. They really have a lot of emotion in the face, especially in the eyes. It also is part of this bigger thing, which is why Aurora and Philip are one of my OTPs for Disney. Everyone in Aurora's life has told her how her life's gonna be, has given her no choice in things, from listening to the curse, from her parents betrothing her when she's still a baby, from the fairies giving her these blessings that she doesn't really get any say in. And Prince Philip is the first person to let her dictate the terms of her future. And I can see why she would fall head over heels for someone who's like, hey, I want to see you again, when can I meet you? And she says, oh, never. He's like, really? And she says, tonight. And he's like, oh, okay. I appreciate that he's someone who's giving her that space, and it makes sense to me. She'd be brokenhearted at finding out that everyone around her has lied, and the only choice she's ever really gotten to make is one that's now being taken away from her.
So I have written down my notes in, like, quotation marks, I'm so upset that I can't meet the stranger I just met. And after your inspired speech, I am willing to rescind that.
And it's more an analytic thing than a elegant storytelling thing. I'll give you the, like, Disney going too fast with romance thing. This is one of the times that I'm more okay with it. Let's get into Fox and the Hound.
The pseudo-sequel to Bambi.
A little bit. Definitely the spiritual sequel.
Yeah.
More happens in this one than in Bambi.
Yeah. Gonna show some of my cards here for a later episode, but I definitely think this is better than Bambi.
But not much better than Bambi. I think Fox and the Hound is great and emotionally moving and heart-wrenching and will make you cry once. But then if you see it again, knowing where it's going, it's maybe less impactful.
It is pretty dark for a Disney film. There's some heavy stuff going on. It starts off with a fox kit being orphaned via gun violence.
And given that animals are sentient in this world, the amount of skins that Amos comes back with in his truck is a little horrifying.
Although, even before the dark opening, some of my first notes were just on some of the cast for this film.
Oh, yeah.
So, for those of you who don't know, Kurt Russell is in this. Corey Feldman is also in this. They play the same character. Corey Feldman plays young Copper, and then Kurt Russell plays adult Copper.
The novelty of some of these actors who we know from later movies being here wears off a little thin if you don't like listening to kids talk.
I mean, it does have the Corey Feldman problem that I have, where I'm always disappointed when his voice is not coming out of a giant anthropomorphic turtle.
That said, most of the voice acting is pretty good. Not, like, stellar, but I'm not put off by them. Apart from, I mean, Chief is very clearly the Sheriff of Nottingham, but the Sheriff of Nottingham was a pretty evocative character, so... Speaking of voice actors, we've got Pearl Bailey as Big Mama, and I think she's the first chronological black woman to play a significant character in a Disney movie?
Possibly. I mean, we're going to get into weird territory if we start thinking of, like, the live-action stuff.
Oh, I meant, like, you know, hashtag Disney animated classics.
Yeah. Well, I'm also talking about some of the sort of vignette films that they produced during the war period, where they're just kind of a bunch of shorts. There might be some stuff going on there, especially if you think of The Three Caballeros or Song of the South.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's a good point. Speaking of racial caricatures, I will say that while Big Mama's a fun character, she's also a bit of the mammy archetype.
Yeah, it's a little uncomfortable. It's not too bad. I've definitely seen it worse. It's not like Tom and Jerry levels of mammy.
And it's more her role in the story than anything else, but...
She definitely is a bit of a magical Negro.
Yeah. She also has most of the songs, and I think they could have been used better.
Well, we are touching on the race stuff here. There is also some benefit to having Pearl Bailey here, as she's the one who gives Todd the talk about Copper being a hunter and hunters going after foxes and all that. And there's definitely some parallels that can be drawn from this film to the current political atmosphere of police brutality against young black men.
While there's probably some parallels, digging too deep into this movie as like a one-to-one allegory is probably going to go badly.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. I don't know if the book it was based on is meant as one. I don't know if this movie is meant as one. I'm sure there are people who have done that analysis, and there are also probably people who really were into Zootopia. I'm not sure where I'm going with that. But yeah, I appreciate that Big Mama has a whole song about why you shouldn't date white cops.
Yeah.
Speaking of homoeroticism... You knew it was coming, as foretold in the prophecy. The relationship between Todd and Copper is a very strong one, and the border between platonic friendship and romantic friendship is a bit thin. Them being animals and therefore playing around in ways that
are more physical than humans would probably get into.
Yeah, definitely doesn't help with that. I'll bet that putting human sexuality onto juvenile animated animals is weird, but I'm from the internet. Talking about relationships, though, let's get into Vixie, who I love as a name. Well, she's a female fox. What do you call her? Well, she's a vixen. Vix-E. Perfect! 10 out of 10.
They couldn't even go with, like, Vicky. They had to be even more lazy than that.
Or, like, Red or Scarlet or something.
There's also the weird bedroom eyes on Vixie, and this is definitely a movie that spawned a lot of furries.
As far as relationships go, this is hashtag not OTP. It's weird that Big Mama tells him they should date, and then Vicky gives him a chance, and then he blows it, and then they just sort of just sit there while Big Mama sings at them, and then they just start cuddling. It doesn't work. It doesn't feel like Todd's earned that relationship.
Yeah, it's not great, but there's so much padding in this film, it's better than a lot of other stuff. Like any scene with the birds and the worm.
Dinky and Boomer.
Oh, another pedantic entomology thing, because once again, my brother will be upset if I don't mention it. The caterpillar has too many legs. Also, Dinky does not have the right beak to be an insectivore. That beak is designed for cracking nuts. This movie does not understand biology at all. Oh, I also forgot to mention that there's no way that the caterpillar's life cycle would last over a year.
Also, because most animals in this universe seem to be sentient, including that caterpillar, who definitely reacts with complex emotions like shock, comfort, arrogance, etc., for these two characters who were following to pretend to eat another sentient being feels weird and uncomfortable, especially with the themes of hunting bad in this movie.
There's also some animals don't have that sentience and intelligence, like the trout that Todd tries to catch for Vixie or the bear towards the end of the film.
Ah, the bear scene.
The bear scene has some of the best animation in this film. But beyond that fight scene, the animation is really inconsistent.
I don't know if it's because this was like a restoration or something, but there's a lot of scenes where the lines look weird and tacked on. It looks like bad CGI from a movie on the Sci-Fi Channel.
Like, some of the scenes are really great. Some of the emotions and facial expressions we get from Willow Tweed, especially towards the beginning of the film, are really well done. But there's other scenes that look terrible.
And Widow Tweed has that car that looks shockingly good and probably wasn't CGI. But going back to that bear, a thing that would have helped this movie a lot, I think, is if they'd had more of that where it's all expressions and animation and music and this very beautiful, naturalistic lighting and environment and mist. And the bear's great hulking form feels so fluid because you have all that excess fur, and its red glowing eyes make it feel more like a demon and less like a natural being. If the whole film had kept that emotional intensity of the wild, it would probably feel a lot better.
It also probably would have made the "Can you feel the love tonight?" scene between Todd and Vixie a little less weird.
Yes. The bear fight kind of feels like something from a Fantasia movie. Like, you could put that to, like, a really good term for a classical music piece that's intense. I don't know them. And you'd have a really good 10-minute segment.
That's honestly the problem with this movie. A lot of the stuff maybe works as segments, but you can tell it's padding out a plot that should not take 90 minutes to tell.
Like, if they'd gone to the circus for 20 minutes or whatever, that might have helped things.
Unfortunately, there's just not enough story here to make it worth a feature-length film. This probably could have been, like, an episode of a TV series. Mm. Or, like, a one-hour special on, like, Disney Channel or something.
In a making fun of old-timey sexism way, I like that Amos just keeps calling Widow Tweed
female, woman, 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 widow, female.
Sexism is bad, but laughing at exaggerated sexism in kids' movies can be fun.
I also really do like that she just takes a shotgun and blows out his radiator.
Yeah. Where's the Widow Tweed prequel movie?
All I could think of is, do we find out how she became a widow? Did she murder her husband?
She seems generally pretty sad and lonely at the start, so I'm going to assume he died of, like, natural causes or a bear attack or in the war or something. But I would also accept, like, how Widow Tweed got away with murder.
Equalizers get on that. All right, it's about that time. Let's render our final decision for this week.
I am more excited about Sleeping Beauty. It definitely has faults, but I had fun during it.
I would agree. Sleeping Beauty is definitely the better film here. There's just not enough interesting stuff going on with Fox and the Hound to keep your attention for those 90 minutes.
I'll say this, though. We watched them one right after the other, and I don't know if, like, watching Fox and the Hound for the first time, if you're a kid who really likes animals, is going to be stronger than watching Sleeping Beauty for the first time, keeping track of all of the fairly complicated plot elements. So this might also just be us being cynical bastards, but I think that Fox and the Hound doesn't quite hold up in the long run.
No, there's a lot of talking animal movies that came out during this time period. I'm sure you can find a couple of them that are better than this.
Such as?
Secret of Nim.
Yes! Okay, fair enough, yeah. What's up next?
Next week will actually be the halfway point for round one of our bracket. We'll be tackling Peter Pan versus 2000's Dinosaur. Not the good dinosaur that came out a few years from Pixar, but the 2000 CGI movie about the iguanodon named Aladar.
And what you mean by not the good dinosaur, the title is The Good Dinosaur. We're not saying the dinosaur is not the good one. We're just saying these titles are different. I don't know if it's good or not. I haven't seen it in ages.
Well, I have to see. It's not like Peter Pan doesn't have its own massive flaws.
Yeah.
Also, I'm going to apologize now, but there's going to be a lot of us channeling Jurassic Park and saying, Dinosaur!
Dinosaur!
Baby Dinosaur.
Well, this has been another episode of the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. Thanks for joining us, and we hope we see you next week.